First, Sam Stein. Sam teaches urban planning at John Jay College in New York. He's the author of a review of Eric Alterman's new book on Bill de Blasio's first year in office. De Blasio's election as mayor of New York in November 2013 inspired a lot of commentary about how he represented the turn away from neoliberalism and a turn towards reducing inequality. Reality, unsurprisingly, is more complex. Sam Stein. Eric Alterman of The Nation has a new book out about the Bill de Blasio administration. He gets some things right, gets some things wrong. What, to start with, do you think he and de Blasio got right?
He describes de Blasio's first year as a sort of bold experiment in local progressive democracy. It would be foolish to ignore the things that de Blasio has done well. I think a lot of us are pretty happy that the universal pre-K, pre-kindergarten program went through. There was a lot of doubt that he would be able to get it done. And that's a really significant expansion of the public education sector. And Alterman rightly credits him for that and shows that he did it in spite of Governor Cuomo's blocking of a tax increase to pay for it. The municipal ID program, I think some people are rightly skeptical that that could have security implications down the line. But
this is mostly going to people outside New York, so could you just explain what that's all about?
Yes, absolutely. So the municipal ID program is a way to give all New York residents, regardless of citizenship, an ID card. And that will give them access to banks, to buildings that require ID to get in, all sorts of benefits and things that people with ID take for granted. And it is specifically targeted at undocumented immigrants. They added a number of cultural benefits to it in order to make sure that people who are citizens who otherwise wouldn't need this ID go out and get it, so then it's not a marker that everyone who has it is undocumented. He reformed the policies around work requirements for homeless people to receive benefits. There was this really Byzantine and much hated employment training program that homeless people had to go through. It was really demeaning. It wasn't particularly helpful in getting employment. And it also prevented a lot of homeless people from going to school, which was ultimately a much more important and effective job program. So de Blasio's administration got rid of that, and that met a huge demand from homeless New Yorkers. So these are all important, genuinely progressive things that de Blasio has done and should get credit for.
And of course, he's attracted national attention because people said this is part of a backlash against the neoliberalism and growing inequality of the last several decades. And you know, he has a history with the Sandinistas. He made a phone call of congratulation to Syriza. He's got somewhat more than liberal record here that people are impressed by. But there are some flies in the ointment, aren't there?
Absolutely. I think it's really true that this guy has a more than liberal background and probably has a more than liberal ideology, but that doesn't mean that the way that he governs is outside of the structures of neoliberalism.
But of course, we also should point out that he did work for Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton.
Yes, absolutely. He's 100% inside the Democratic machine. He spent 6 years working for either the Clintons or the Cuomos or both at the same time. So to see him as entirely outside of the more conservative Democratic politics is a lie.
In New York City, and I guess most big cities, real estate really comes pretty close to running the show in New York City with the help of Wall Street. De Blasio has attracted a lot of attention for his affordable housing program, which is something you've written about separately as well. What's that all about, and what's it look like?
You know, they say real estate in New York is like oil in Texas, which is absolutely true. It's the thing that runs all the politics here. It's the thing behind most economic activity. De Blasio pretty early in his administration came out with what he described as the boldest affordable housing policy in America. The big picture numbers were 200,000 affordable apartments. And if you looked a little bit closer, that was preserving the affordability of 120,000 apartments and then creating 80,000 new affordable apartments. If you look a little bit closer than that, the definition of what it means to preserve is a little bit vague. The numbers that need to be preserved are far over 120,000. And the new affordable housing that's being created is being done almost entirely through a program called inclusionary zoning.
Now, what is the vague definition of preserve that they're using?
It means to keep it affordable. So if it's in one of the many different affordability programs that are in play in New York City, it will stay in that program or move to a different program, but it will stay under the general rubric of affordability.
Okay, and then there's inclusionary zoning, which is popular not just in New York, but elsewhere. What's that all about?
Yeah, inclusionary zoning is a method of creating housing that's being used in New York City, but also in Boston, Washington, D.C., San Diego, San Francisco. It's also very popular in Europe. The idea is cities can use zoning as a way to steer the market towards lower cost housing. Zoning, of course, is the way that cities guide what gets built where, how big it is, what types of use are going to be allowed. Inclusionary zoning says that a certain percentage of new construction has to be somehow below market rate. And there's a pretty big range of differences between cities of how that's been done. In New York City, for the past few years, it's been an optional program. So developers could build more than the zoning would otherwise allow if they either set aside about 20% of their building at below market rents, or built an equivalent of that somewhere else, or paid into a fund for the construction of affordable housing.
Now, this is what prevailed in the Bloomberg years.
That's right. It was a program that was around before Bloomberg, but Bloomberg really staked his claims to affordable housing creation on inclusionary zoning.
Okay, and then the de Blasio innovations are?
To make it bigger. It doesn't really change the program dramatically. It moves it from optional to mandatory, but only mandatory in places that the city rezones for more density. So it's not like a blanket that covers the entire city. It relies on the de Blasio City Planning Department going in and doing these targeted neighborhood rezonings that will greatly increase the building capacity in local areas. Within that, they're saying some percentage will be affordable. No matter what, they have to build more market rate, which in New York City means luxury housing, at the same time. So this is not a program that creates just affordable housing in places. It creates a whole bunch of expensive housing. A little bit of it may be affordable. So in neighborhoods that are going through gentrification right now or on the verge of going into gentrification, this is really going to accelerate it much more than it's going to push back against it.
Now, I'm sitting in Clinton Hill, which is a neighborhood that's sort of the one of the major gentrification corridors that run from downtown Brooklyn through Bedford-Stuyvesant. This process has been underway in this part of Brooklyn for a long time, but the de Blasio administration is focusing on other neighborhoods now that have yet been untouched by the magic of gentrification, right, like East New York.
Yes, it's interesting where he's looking. It's places that have, as you said, not been touched by the magic of gentrification. It's also places that Bloomberg didn't recently rezone. So he's not going back and re-rezoning the places that got the worst of the Bloomberg treatment. He is sort of looking at what was left out of that. In many places, these are areas with low land values, so they can argue that there's an economic rationale for building affordable housing there rather than a place where simply buying the land would be more expensive. But the places that they've talked about are East New York, which for non-New Yorkers is the far east side of Brooklyn, and interestingly enough was the receiving site of the most displaced people by gentrification under the Bloomberg years. It was the only neighborhood in Brooklyn that increased in percentage of African-American residents during the Bloomberg years. He's also talked about rezoning Jerome Avenue in the Bronx, which is an area of low-cost housing and light industrial use. He's talked about East Harlem, potentially. Also, the area near where Eric Garner was murdered is talked about as a possibility for upzoning. So all these neighborhoods will see a flood of new development, some small percentage of which might be cheaper than the market, but all of which will probably be cheaper than what's there right now. I'm sorry, more expensive than.
But now a cynic would look at these neighborhoods and say, well, you know, these are the few that have yet been untouched by that magical gentrification. And so that under the guise of an affordable housing program, this is actually a backdoor way to gentrify these neighborhoods. Is that too cynical?
Not at all. I think the city recognizes that there are places in New York that have not seen the speed of land value accumulation that others have. And the city has for decades used public policy to spur gentrification. This is why we can't call the de Blasio administration entirely progressive or living up to the semi-socialist ideals that the mayor occasionally espouses. This is a gentrification and displacement plan under the guise of an affordable housing plan.
I'm speaking with Sam Stein, who teaches urban planning at John Jay College in New York and is the author of a review of Eric Alterman's new book on Mayor Bill de Blasio, published on the Jacobin website. Well, people will look at, you know, at some of the things that he said about creating affordable housing plan, you know, the setting aside of a certain number of units for low and moderate income people, and be impressed by this. Like, what's wrong with this? This sounds good. Okay, we're building some new buildings for the wealthy, but, you know, they're also building stuff for people of more modest means as well. How are they defining affordable, low and moderate income? These definitions are very crucial. What's the detail behind the words?
They're crucial and they're also shaky. Usually the tool that cities use to define low, moderate, middle income is called area median income, or AMI. The area is not the neighborhood. It's not even the city. It's the city plus its much more expensive suburbs. It's the metropolitan area as defined by the federal government. So when we say, well, we're building housing for people at 60% of area median income, that may sound like people who aren't making a lot of money. In truth, it's above the average rate for the people who live in these neighborhoods already. In many cases, it's twice as much as the average for a given census tract where they're building this housing.
Yeah, I did some quick calculations around East New York yesterday, and it seemed like their definition of affordable, or of these moderate income, is roughly twice the existing income in East New York.
That's right, and those incomes are about the same around Jerome Avenue, where they're talking about rezoning. They're also the same in Chinatown, where I've done a good deal of research, and neighborhood groups there have spent 7 years coming together and trying to come up with their own rezoning plan and presenting it to the city. They were recently told by Carl Weisbrod, the Department of City Planning chair, that their plan would not be accepted by the city because it was too ambitious and preserved too much housing.
Weisbrod is an important figure because I remember when I saw he was appointed as the co-chair of de Blasio's transition team. This is a guy who ran the Economic Development Corporation, who handled the Times Square redevelopment, who worked for one of the real estate firms. I can't remember which one now. This is a guy who came out of the real estate world and the state enablers of the real estate world, who is going to be an architect of an affordable housing program. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't make any sense, except if we think of this as less of an affordable housing program than a development and gentrification program. Carl Weisbrod's background is in state-supported high-end development. That's what he knows how to do. Presumably, that's what he's going to do in these neighborhoods that de Blasio has singled out for development. And he's shown already that when neighborhoods come up with their own plans, when they take the time to do genuine community planning, he's not particularly interested if it doesn't follow the model that he's already presented.
There's actually a cynical real estate interpretation of de Blasio's concern about the carriage horses in Central Park, too, isn't there?
Yes. So the carriage horse debate has been lively in New York City for a while. We have a tourist-based industry of horse-drawn carriages that take people around Central Park. The debate in the press has focused around the fact that animal rights advocates, rightfully in my opinion, say that it's not great for horses to have to walk down 10th Avenue traffic every day in order to get to Central Park as they get from the horse stables, which are on the far west side of Manhattan, to Central Park. And then you have on the other side these sort of right-wing populists who say, who cares about horses? You're all a bunch of liberals. Or you have the unions that represent the horse carriage drivers saying, these are good union jobs that you're getting rid of. De Blasio has generally taken the side of those who want to get rid of the horse carriages, and I think on the surface it would appear that he's speaking up for the poor horses. Isn't he great? Well, the biggest campaign contributor to the program to get rid of the horse carriages is connected to a group called Edison Property, and their business model is to buy up land that zoning currently makes not that expensive, get the zoning changed, and then sell it for a whole lot more. They often do this with parking lots. They own a number of parking lots in Chinatown, for example, which everyone is expecting to get rezoned in the future. There's every reason to believe that their interest is in making a lot of money off of the conversion of the horse stables into high-end housing. So sure, de Blasio might like horses, but it's much more likely that he's trying to turn these stables into a money-making enterprise.
And he's also gotten attention for police reforms. How much has he transformed, certainly the police don't like him very much, it appears, but how much has he actually transformed the practices of the NYPD?
Yeah, he ran his campaign on issues of inequality, and a lot of that focused on the police themselves. Bloomberg had instituted a policy called Stop and Frisk, or really expanded an existing policy called Stop and Frisk, which allowed or encouraged police officers to stop and frisk mostly young Black and Latino men and women, especially in neighborhoods that were going through gentrification. And so it became an easy way for the police to go after young Black people, arrest them for trumped up charges, and it was a real disgrace in the city. De Blasio ran saying he was going to reform this policy. He never actually said he would get rid of it, but he said he was going to fix it. Before he came into office, a federal judge said this whole thing is unconstitutional and it has to be dismantled. So de Blasio comes in and he does dismantle the formal stop and frisk policy, but one of his first appointments is a guy named Bill Bratton as police commissioner. Bratton is most known in New York as being one of Rudy Giuliani's police commissioners who presided over a really terrible period of police abuse and overstepping of people's rights. There were a number of controversial cases of beatings and police murders. This is the guy that de Blasio brought in to run his newly so-called reformed police department. And since he came in, Bratton has brought back what's called broken windows policing, which is aggressively targeting very small offenses or non-offenses in many cases. The number of misdemeanor arrests has actually gone up from the last year of the Bloomberg era to the first year of the de Blasio era. There's been targeting of homeless people, especially on the subways. There's the same racial disparities that there were in marijuana arrests and trespassing. It's still 90% people of color. So while we've seen a sort of reform in the policing, the general pattern remains the same and in some cases has even gotten worse.
And then the style of governance that you describe is interesting, a culture of consultation. Talk about that.
That's right. De Blasio often criticized Bloomberg for not consulting with communities enough in doing things like co-locating charter schools and putting charter schools inside of regular neighborhood district public schools. He said the mayor needs to consult with communities and tell them what he's going to do. So if that's de Blasio's critique of Bloomberg, presumably what he's going to do is consult more, which is really a communication strategy. It's a way of telling people what the government intends to do. It masquerades as a community planning process and as some sort of democratic participation. But if you are just telling local groups what you intend to do so that they know about it before it happens, it doesn't really give them any chance to shape the policies or to propose their own.
Well, this is also a page out of the Clinton book. Both Hillary and Bill did these listening tours. They listen, but it's not clear that it has any influence on what they do.
Right. It's therapeutic, perhaps, for people to have a chance to vent at government, but it's possibly even worse to hear people out and then not do what they want than to tell people, this is what we're going to do.
I remember there's a great scene in, or series of scenes in My Brooklyn documentary of hearings about the transformation of downtown Brooklyn before the Economic Development Corporation. They'd already decided what they're going to do, and all the members of the EDC are sitting on their side of the table, looking really bored. But they've already made up their mind. They're pretending to listen, but it's an absolutely ineffectual process.
Yeah, there's a critique of this kind of planning that it takes activist energy away from building real power or fighting back against political machines. It instead brings them into the system, lets them vent, and then they're completely ignored. Francis Fox Piven wrote about this in the 1960s. It's still happening today.
And both de Blasio and Alterman look to Mayor LaGuardia, the mayor, not the airport, as a model of what de Blasio is all about. You say a liberal with socialist tendencies who reshaped the city in a way that worked for the wealthy. What do you mean by that?
Mayor LaGuardia is an interesting figure. He's remembered as a great reformer, a guy who built a lot of infrastructure, a champion of public housing. He supported Irish independence and the Russian Revolution, though not what came afterward. He was affiliated with the American Labor Party for a while. So the left tries to usually lionize LaGuardia as our best mayor and the model for how to do municipal socialism. The thing is, LaGuardia also had a number of much more questionable impacts. So yes, he did build a great deal of public housing, but he did so by demolishing huge amounts of low-income housing. These were tenements that weren't in great shape, but the public housing that was built did a really terrible job of bringing back the people who were displaced by it. It was a process known as slum clearance, which I think if anyone came out saying that's what they were doing today, they would be booed off the stage by the left. But at the time, that was the lingo. He was also known for getting rid of street vendors and making the sort of appearance of the city much more friendly to business. There were a number of indoor sort of street vendor systems that were set up, like the Essex Street Market in the Lower East Side, the goal of which was to get vendors off the street and institutionalize them. When we do that today, as Giuliani did in Harlem, as Bloomberg did with the expansion of business improvement districts, the left is very critical of that sort of thing. So the LaGuardia, his legacy is very mixed. And we see that being repeated in de Blasio. De Blasio came to power saying he loved LaGuardia. LaGuardia was his ideal of what a mayor should be. The truth is de Blasio is following this model by picking up on some progressive policies, but the overall thrust continues in that direction towards real estate speculation, towards the accumulation of power for Wall Street, and doesn't really reshape any of those big fundamental inequalities.
So in sum, it seems like de Blasio represents a modest change for the better in some areas, but overall not a rejection of the politics of the last several decades.
I think so. And I think in some ways he's doing the politics of the last several decades in a more sustainable way. And there's a real danger in that. If you take bad policy and shine it up, it goes down a little bit easier.
That was Sam Stein, who teaches at CUNY's John Jay College. His review of Eric Alterman's book and his analysis of Bill de Blasio's housing plan can both be found on the web at jacobinmag.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. We'll That was some of We Are All Bourgeois Now by McCarthy. Next, Jody Dean. Jody is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. Her review of Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything is on her blog, iCite, whose address is jdeanicite, as in jdeanicite.typepad.com. Jody Dean. Welcome, Jody. Let's talk some climate here. Before we get to your critique of Naomi Klein's book, you say in the beginning of this piece, there's climate change is unconscious, the stuff of stress, inconvenience, anxiety, repression, the enjoyment of change, destruction, punishment, the enjoyment business. What is enjoyable, in some sense, about climate catastrophe?
Well, first I should say that I'm using enjoyment in a little bit of a kind of technical term of art sort of way from Lacanian psychoanalysis, where enjoyment refers to an intense pleasure pain that makes life worth living. And so for this notion of enjoyment, it's not just kind of pleasure. It's more the way that we can become attached to things that are both pleasurable and unpleasurable at once. Like being in love. Being in love can be painful and suck, but still it makes life worth living. Or the way that sometimes we might poke on something that's sore, which seems really strange, but we do it to feel that intensity. So when I'm thinking about this enjoyment of climate change, what I started noticing is how people really like to circulate the disaster pictures or the countdown scenarios or the increasingly bad numbers or the, oh, we've passed the tipping point, or we're almost at the tipping point, or here's not yet another place that's flooded, destroyed, or burned. And so it seems like our constant repetition of these images of disaster and hopelessness is something that we're starting to enjoy. So I've been wondering, okay, in what way? What are we enjoying about it? Well, I think there are multiple things. One hand, we can say that it seems like there's a relief, like we don't have to solve any more problems. If it's the case that we're already doomed, then any sorts of efforts to change our lifestyle or have a better government or build a stronger, more just society, that's down the drain. We don't even have to worry about it. Things were already doomed. I think for in other ways, we enjoy climate change because it lets us feel like, yeah, there really is a last judgment. And some people really are going down. So we have this internal, and back now in a Freudian lexicon, that would be our superego. And the superego really likes to punish. And so we can punish other people for all of their bad ways of life. We can kind of punish ourselves like, oh, yeah, we never should have driven all those gas-guzzling SUVs. We shouldn't have been so consumerist. I guess we're getting our own. So I think that one of the things that's part of the current, climate of climate change, we can understand psychoanalytically in terms of these sorts of enjoyments, right? Or enjoying being in the know, enjoying punishment, and enjoying the kind of relief about not having to actually change anything because we're already doomed.
Now, that kind of enjoyment that you describe, which I can certainly see in the connoisseurs of climate catastrophe, there are also people who enjoy their air conditioning in their car. And this is not the way to build a mass political movement. This is a kind of a niche enjoyment that most people cannot participate in this enjoyment. And many people would be turned off by this notion of inevitability and chaos and collapse. How do you build a political movement around the pornography of disaster?
I think that's a really good point. I actually don't think that the pornography of disaster builds a political movement. And I think that for those of us who are actually concerned about climate change and want to build a political movement, we need to start becoming more critical of and distancing ourselves from this disaster porn or this climate porn. And so we can think about some of the disaster literature then a different way, the kind of low-level anxiety or apprehension that's also part of it. And those low-level apprehensions or low-level anxieties are manifest more in things like, huh, which numbers are right? Are these numbers or those numbers? If I make a little change, is that going to work? And here, with those, the market orientation tends to take over. Well, people start to think, oh, if I just get these better light bulbs or this better car, then I'm doing my part. Disaster climate stuff isn't really going to get us to a big movement. For that, we're going to actually need to connect climate politics with real class issues. We'll need to make sure that we connect it with the kinds of large-scale policy changes that most people can see in their daily lives. So we can talk about changes in public transportation, changes in public housing, changes in the energy grid, changes in the way that government spending works. You know, how does the government fund different kinds of gas-driven vehicles? By gasoline. That's where bigger changes are going to come. But nonetheless, we shouldn't totally erase the low-level anxieties that accompany people's sense or sensibility around the climate. I think that the right does this really effectively by mobilizing our doubts. Like, oh, how do we know which numbers to believe? And as long as our doubts are mobilized, we're a little bit protected from actually really grappling with the fact that it looks like within the next 10 or 15 years, if things don't change, then the temperature escalation is going to lock in.
Okay, this is a nice hook to or segue into Naomi Klein's book. She argues that the climate crisis is a tremendous way to begin talking about getting beyond capitalism to some post-capitalist future. The climate, as you put it, climate change becomes the basis for a stronger left politics, which you say is a crucial political move, but she falls short in some respects. Let's start talking about how she falls short. You know, you quote a bit from the early in the book where she talks about, for example, demanding the rebuilding and reviving of local economies and to reclaim our democracies from corrosive corporate influence. So there are two issues here that she talks about, which you have problems with. Let's start with the local as the dimension of economic restructuring.
So here, this is the most frustrating thing about Naomi Klein's book is, on the one hand, she emphasizes the importance of long-term planning, and she emphasizes the importance of changes in the transportation and housing infrastructure. Those are great. That's absolutely true. And those are key sites for a combined red-green politics that would really help the left in the U.S. and globally. But what does this mean to talk about this in terms of localities? I keep thinking about, like, you know, my God, like localities in some parts of this country would end up being all white and trying to make sure that no people of color are in their local, right? That their energy grid is going to be just for protecting their gated community and for keeping all of their very small, very racially, very class-identified group safe from those who might be parasitic on it. Klein actually has a different version. Hers is primarily in terms of indigenous people, and most of her examples are from First Nation struggles in Canada. I'm not sure. I don't think this is a good idea for a large-scale red-green coalition, because it depends on indigenous people's own specific tribal communities, tribal lands, tribal practices. If we think about this globally, it makes me start to wonder, okay, how does that work in Germany, right? As soon as one starts saying, oh, yes, we need a climate movement that lets Germans emphasize blood and land, everyone will rightly say, no, that's wrong. So Klein gives a vision that is supposed to be internationalist or global, but yet it relies on a blood and land approach to community, right? And a version of indigeneity that actually is impossible to scale. It can only be kind of a fragmenting, and it can only reinforce attachments between communities in a very, very identity-based idea of these communities and their specific land. I mean, it seems to me to be the other side of rich people's enclaving. Now, this is more, you could call it poor people's enclaving or indigenous people's enclaving, but it will not be able to address thousands and thousands of people migrating from the front lines of climate disaster as they try to get into places that are dry or not drought-ridden or have possible ways of living there. So on this score, honestly, Christian Parenti's account of the Tropics of Chaos is much more compelling because it really makes us have to think about the impact of global migration and immigration in ways that Naomi Klein can't let us think at all because of her focus on locality via an indigenous people's framework.
She lives in Toronto. I live in Brooklyn. Both these places are very large, very diverse entities for which this indigenous model has no relevance at all.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, and I keep thinking, like, how if she says that we need to think about these communities whose basic experience means that they are completely going to be defenders of the land. And I'm thinking, is there a community anywhere ever that has been fully devoted to the land? In fact, all communities are split, right? They're always, I mean, this is what, in good old-fashioned Marxist terms, this is what class struggle is. It's about the inherent split within any community. And even in among indigenous people's groups, there are splits between people who want to do some things with the land and people who want to do other things with the land. We know in U.S. versions, some of these things that people want to do might involve casinos. What others might want to do might involve kinds of agriculture. We know from Latin American countries that some people want to do extractive mining. Others want to take care of the land in ways that don't allow mining. But it's simply not the case that any group, just because they are indigenous, that any group is totally uniform. The split goes all the way through. And so it's important if we're thinking about how to build a coalition for climate politics that we don't reify indigenous communities, but recognize the splits in them, recognize that these splits go across all of our societies and think, okay, given this, how do we build something that doesn't romanticize some people, but think about what do we need? What we need are forms of energy supply, forms of transportation supply, forms of housing supply that are low in emissions and can serve the largest numbers of people.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, who's a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. Whenever I hear this sort of indigenous romanticism, I think of Adorno's aphorism, the image of undistorted nature arises only in distortion as its opposite. You see that all around environmental discourse, this notion of idealized nature before the fall, which is a pretty fantasy, but doesn't really have much to do with our lives.
Yeah, it seems to me to also go together with a kind of peasantization as the only alternative that we have. And I think that some local food emphases become a kind of neo-peasant or a kind of peasantization. Some are not. Some are saying some approaches to food actually are much more pragmatic, recognizing that there are a whole variety of ways that people can have some large-scale agriculture, some small-scale agriculture, different forms of agriculture. But there's a strong tendency in Klein's romantic approach to locality and indigeneity that makes it seem like her version of a new kind of changed climate future is one where the vast majority of people are spending most of their time in agriculture, and that, in fact, there seems to be very little space for cities.
This takes us to the whole of the center, as you see it, the absence of any sense of, and you're not afraid to use the word, which most people are, communism. What is this absence, and how does it figure into the deficiencies in Klein's book?
One of the things that's really frustrating about Klein's This Changes Everything is that she only changes some things. She's not willing to recognize that the communist movements of the 19th and 20th century, even the socialist movements, even the labor movements of the 19th and 20th century, in fact, have great models of large-scale organizing and large-scale political change focused on the economy. So the weird thing in her book is that even as she says that capitalism is the problem, even as she recognizes that if we don't do something about capitalism, things are going to get desperately, desperately worse, she holds back and doesn't draw from the organizing experiences of the communist movement. She doesn't go so far as to say we have to eliminate capitalism. Instead, she has a few tweaks here and there. It's a kind of green Keynesianism that doesn't even allow for the fact that it was socialist, communist, and labor struggles that even let Keynesianism be a possibility at all. And one more thing, there's another way that her, I would almost say anti-communism, though that might be too strong, but her non-communism manifests. So throughout the book, she is calling for big change and saying we have to transform everything. Though she also says, well, of course, we don't want any of the vanguardist revolution. We want to make sure that we don't have any revolution. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, if you have been talking about the hold of the capitalist class essentially on the planet in ways that is leading to planetary disaster that puts the human race on the verge of extinction, why are you putting this stopping point in that says, well, of course, we don't want any kind of revolution? Like, well, if there's not a reason for revolution with the extinction of the species, then why not? I mean, when would there be a necessary for would there be a need for revolution? It seems to me like the end of the species would be at least one ground for revolution. Additionally, she makes all of this effort to talk about mass mobilization, and I keep wondering, so if people are mobilized, what if they start to go in the direction of revolution? Is she saying that states should stop them? Is she saying that people should stop themselves? I mean, why? This is, and I think that the problem here is throwing out the entire communist and socialist tradition and being unable to look at what happens when movements actually really get going and revolution becomes the reality of people's struggle.
And she also makes such a very large fetish of democracy. That seems to be the goal as well as the means of achieving the goal. But as you point out from your own personal experiences in the struggle around fracking in upstate New York, very often the outcomes are democratic. You just don't like the outcome of the democratic proceedings. I mean, what is this this obsession with democracy almost as an end in itself?
Yeah, this is another odd part to me in Klein's book. So it's, and one of the things that's odd is it's not 100% clear if she's emphasizing where she wants to emphasize democracy. If she's saying, okay, we cannot change the political system that we are in. And so we have to, that's what democratic change means, is using this system, but having social movements that put pressure. If that's the case, then it seems to me that given all of her own terms, we will not address climate change in a democratic way because the time frame that the democratic system that we have provides is simply too long, right? The change that she emphasizes over and over again has to happen within the next 10 or 15 years, can't happen within the democratic system we have. So on the one hand, it seems like she means the system can't change. Other times it seems like Klein wants to say that no, it's the movements are about making communities more democratic. That is not my experience. In my experience, communities are split. They're split around, so in New York State, they're split on fracking, or they're split around gas storage, or they're split around industry. And some people, namely those who own those industries or work in them, want to keep them going. And so they put on pressure on the political system to support their version, and the others of us contest it. So it's not about democracy, right? It's about struggle, and it's about a struggle for power. And I guess it's the case that Klein uses democracy as a placeholder to avoid saying that what's at stake in climate change is a struggle for power. And if she would acknowledge the struggle for power, then she might not have to use this kind of insipid appeal to a democracy that in some ways we already have. It's just that some of us really disagree with the complacent, bought-out majority.
And the agents of this non-revolutionary change that she points to are, as you point out, we're back to the old alternative globalization movement, the movement of movements, the multitudes, all these things that, dinosaurs like us, evade the concept and language of class.
Right. In This Changes Everything, Klein transfers the movement of movements that had characterized her account of the alter-globalization movement now to Blockadia. And so Blockadia is her term for the multiplicity of struggles around the world, but primarily North America for her examples, but around the world for people opposing fracking, opposing gas and oil storage and pipeline facilities, opposing oil trains and extractivist mining. And so she looks at all of these very specific small projects and thinks of them as one big project, Blockadia. Now, that's kind of great, right? It lets us see across a lot of actions the potential for one single movement. But the problem is that she doesn't let us actually get a sense of how do they combine, right? The only place that the movements actually combine is her language and her imaginary, right? Not in terms of the actual building of a network of struggles. So some of the groups talk to each other, but each plan remains specific, a very specific struggle. Sometimes they might come together like in a giant march. Again, this is the same thing as the alter-globalization movement, but they don't come together in a way that tries to branch out to build into more sectors of society. They don't come together to provide arguments for legislation. They don't come together to build a common policy. So it really seems like more of the small action, try to target the center and hope that in their multiplicity, they exert something like political power. I think the problem here is that given that they don't form a kind, given that they don't coalesce into a party that will then propose some kind of stronger political change, whether or not it's with office holders or policies, it's a lot easier for the pressure to be used to say, to be used by politicians to do things like say, oh, look at our market-oriented approach here. We're doing exactly what you want. Or look at, like with the Obama administration's new regulations on fracking, they're saying, oh, you know, these are going to help there be more safe, clean, good fracking. And they can, and with that kind of move, they can say, oh, we're responding to the claims of the different fracking groups. We're responding to the movement pushback. And given that the movement is not a strong group, right, strong as a collective, it's only strong as little multiple things, you can't fight back, right? It seems like you get co-opted much more easily.
And then you've mentioned policies and office holders a couple of times, but the state is a missing actor in Klein's model, isn't it?
Yeah, on the one hand, it seems like she acknowledges the importance of essentially the international level of trade agreements and the potential to embed within that framework regulations that can be more, say, climate friendly. But she doesn't let the state become something that people would seize or use. It's really abstracted. So it's almost like only a location for international agreements rather than an agency that that people can use to make change on a large scale.
Finally, she's opposed to the vanguardist model of politics, but what is Blockadia but some kind of vanguard force?
That's exactly what I think. Klein presents Blockadia as a vanguard at the same time as she denies the term vanguard. I think this should be a clue to all of us that Vanguard is just a throwaway term right now. It's a kind of residual anti-communism that people feel happily throwing out, like, oh, you know, we're against vanguards. But it's a vanguard saying that. To my mind, this means that we should now happily reclaim the term vanguard, recognize that that's what anyone who is advocating for a strong movement for social change, that's what they mean, and let's just hold on to it. Let's stop relying on the Cold War to determine which words we can use and why some are permissible and some are not.
That was Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. Her review and many other wonderful things can be found at her blog, which is at jdeeniceite, J-D-E-N-I-C-I-T-E, .typepad.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Mekons' 2007 song, Burning in the Desert Burning. Till next week, bye.
Colored flags out.